When you picture a greener future, what do you see? Solar panels? Wind turbine farms? Clean air? These are all likely parts of that future. But my question today is, who is going to make all that stuff happen? Welcome back to the show, everyone. Again, apologies. I have another cold, not the same one as the last one. I don't know what's going on with me, but I apologize. And I do have a cold for the entirety of this episode. So just going to pre-warn you about that. Anyway, today's show, the green revolution. It means big disruption in the labor market. Jobs will be created in the future that need to be filled by skilled workers. Remarkably, we don't have that supply of the skilled workers that we need if we're going to fulfill any meaningful climate change targets. There are a number of reasons for this, all of which are far beyond my understanding, but my guest today is here to break it down. Matt Illich of Greenworks is on a mission to put 10 million people into green jobs in the next 10 years. Jobs that will fight, as Matt puts it, the green skills emergency. Perhaps you work in a field that's under threat of being disrupted, not by climate change per se, but by the shift towards economies that are built around fighting climate change. Now, just before we hear from Matt, I just want to do a very, very quick announcement. I'm not going to do a positive news segment this week. What I'm actually going to do instead is tell you about a really, really amazing charity that I've just got involved with. They're called Mr. X. Now, Mr. X is a toy appeal charity based in South Wales, delivering joy to underprivileged kids at Christmas. It's an amazing cause and something that really hit home for me when I had my little boy. I saw how lucky he was and knowing that elsewhere there were kids far less fortunate. It's really easy to get involved. They're a little bit old school and run primarily off of Facebook group, but I'll put a link in the show notes and it's as simple as giving them a call, saying you'd like to get involved, and they'll give you the name and age of a child for you to go and buy a present for. Then you just drop off the gift at your closest drop-off point and they'll deliver them on your behalf. It's a really fantastic idea, so please do get involved if you're in the South Wales area. And if you're not, don't worry. I know that there are a ton of different toy appeal organisations across the country, not necessarily Mr. X, but I'd urge you to have a quick Google to look for your nearest organisation to get involved with. I think it's a really amazing thing to be able to do at Christmas time. Now, back to the episode. I started asking about the problem at hand. Right. Guess what you've noticed is a shortfall in green skills or people with, you know, the ability to fulfill green jobs. I'm doing green sort of in quotes because I guess we might have to unpick what that might mean. So yeah, tell us kind of, yeah, what the problem is that you're seeing.
Yep. So we're going through a once in a generation structural change in our economies. Everything from where we live or will live, how we'll travel, what kind of energy mix we will consume, and all with a view to both having a different lower carbon future, partly with a view to preserving our planetary boundaries, but also recasting our economies in a way that is more sustainable. And that structural shift is something like the first industrial revolution, but in much shorter time frame. And practically what it's doing is trillions of dollars pointing to green infrastructure investments, so something like $3 trillion every year currently, and rising to about $6 trillion as we head into the next decade. And that investment in capital and infrastructure is driving up a shift in the need for human resources. So both creating new types of job, whole new use cases, as well as realigning and reallocating some existing jobs. And so you have this shift that is both affecting existing work and workers and creating new opportunities for people with specific skills to get involved. And in our definition of this, these are frontline technical roles, but of course there are also these kind of lighter green roles, if you like sustainability managers or your financial controllers that will be interested in looking at scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions in banks. And when you zoom out, a McKinsey report suggests, as does the International Energy Agency, that this is something like 30 million jobs created between now and 2030. And closer to 250 million by the end of 2050. At the same time, most of the developed world is also experiencing workforce contractions. So if you take something like electrotechnical skills in the UK, this is a sector that is disproportionately older, even though we do have an aging population. So a third of our population overall will be 65 plus in 2030. And that will mean 3 million people dropping out of the labor market over the coming 7 years. And that electrotechnical talent is about 30% smaller today than it was back in 2017. So if you fast forward just the next 6 years, you're dealing with actually sectors that have been contracting for a long period of time, lots of reasons for that, and demand that is rising, being driven by capital investment from state subsidies, private investment, consumer demand. And so the skills and the workforce in pure numbers need to rise up to that challenge. They need to rise up an order of magnitude if we are to make the leap in a lower carbon future with all the technologies and the energy systems that we need in order to stay within our planetary back.
Wow, blimey. Okay, so that's, yeah, that's quite the problem. So we're running out of, I mean, even just in pure numbers, we're running out of people within the workforce to fill the kind of jobs that will be made by this transition. So that transition as an industry is ahead of where we are as people. Is this like, is this global? Is this, you know, I'm guessing you're focused in the UK, but is this a global issue?
Yeah, clearly it is a global challenge. Of course, the capability of different nations to rise up to that challenge based on their own demographic situation is going to be different. The sectors are growing about four times faster than, say, technology, which has been a product of the last 20 years of exponential growth. So if you can remember what Facebook was like 20 years ago compared to what Meta is today and what that's done for demand for software engineering skills and AI specialists and all these jobs that were inconceivable in 2002, 2003. And so you fast forward to kind of 20 years from now, the acceleration around this demand is creating huge opportunity, but also creating a significant disruption. And our goal is to create something that can patiently move people into these opportunities and facilitate a more just transition so that people aren't left behind. And to the point about the global differential, some nations are going further faster. So if you look at the very well cited Inflation Reduction Act in the US, this is more than $500 billion. And it's created like 13 million vacancies in the US economy, something like 1.5 million electricians needed between now and the end of the decade. So how do you bridge those gaps? And as I said, yeah, it's happening at different paces, but demand paces and supply capabilities in different nations. But it goes without saying that there are penalties, global penalties, for us getting this wrong, because we can't find ourselves in a future where we're struggling to find people with the requisite skills, in that we will have missed some of the leaps into electrified transportation or, you know, more efficient homes that are less reliant on fossil fuels like gas, that are in more volatile markets.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I wanted to ask you. You know, what are we looking at if we don't get a hold of this? Like, what's the knock-on effects of this runaway kind of, you know, these unfilled jobs and us as a population, as a workforce, just not able to deliver what's needed?
Well, if you look at it in a kind of, in a sense of like our own relationship to the challenge of climate, and then the extent to which we trailed it as an emergency and started looking at it kind of more seriously. So interesting kind of journey from the Paris Climate Agreement to today, where now, as I said, trillions are pointing at this challenge. We are set to maybe land somewhere below 2 degrees, whereas just in 2008, we were looking at north of 3 degrees. How has that happened? The global financial system, both kind of public investment and, you know, commensurate private investment, is now starting to point at solutions. Everything from algae to, you know, decarbonize our seas through to concrete production that doesn't involve carbon. And of course, the massive shift in the role of renewables in our energy mix, be that wind or solar, and the proliferation of EVs and ownership of EVs growing, as I said, at an exponential rate. So these shifts have been happening for some time, and they're starting to accelerate even further. Now, our ability to keep pace with that change requires, continued investment. And I believe very optimistically, or at least realistically, that is set to continue, partly because we're in an age where capitalism recognizes the opportunity, sees the scope to create new types of technology, battery production, recycling facilities, even kind of, you know, mineral extraction, which is obviously not desirable, but is an antidote to having other forms of extraction. And the other piece then being having the workforce that can kind of help us keep pace with that, but also then sort of supply chains. And so what is the penalty? Put simply, we have a skills crisis, a skills emergency within a climate emergency, and not being able to keep pace means that we put the entire transition at risk. So the actual jump into a lower carbon future, net zero at threat. But the related point being that the social consequences of not seizing opportunity and indeed being more exposed to that disruptive challenge of, for instance, manufacturing combustion engine cars requires fewer workers than manufacturing electric vehicles. There are fewer parts. They come partly more, you know, pre-assembled and actually last longer too. So how you avoid this kind of schism that creates a disruption that basically challenges the opportunity of a generation and goes without saying the high stakes significance of that opportunity and actually creates more of this kind of threat narrative that we've seen recently. So it's presented as a net cost without anyone asking the question, what is the cost of not doing it? And of course, the threat to workforce, in spite of the fact that these jobs are good in every definition of a good job, not just pay and conditions, but also their endurance and their heroic and purposeful significance in securing our future.
Well, yeah, the disruption is the thing for me that I really want to try and get my head around, because when I first heard about you guys, I'm kind of reading about what you do and the issues you were pointing to. Like, I mean, I might be off here, but this, it kind of reminded me of singing the same sort of song as what we saw with coal miners and the shift of, you know, it transitioning out of coal, which I think obviously had to happen, right? As an industry, it kind of had to go. But this was my understanding of it was under, under Thatcher, they were kind of let go, these people, in a quite brutal way with no thought as to, you know, what we're going to do with these people, these livelihoods, with these skills, with any of this. And so we now see, you know, ex coal mining towns still with no industry, which is kind of nuts. Do you think there's some similarities here, or is it kind of, you know, it is being done in a slightly more thought out way and people are less likely to be left behind? Like you say, people that might be working in, you know, traditional combustion based vehicles, transitioning to EVs, those manufacturing jobs, are they being, you know, looked after, or is that part of the problem as well?
I guess sort of zooming out, we've had these workforce disruptions as long as kind of humanity has been around. You know, did the phone disrupt the pony post? Did the car disrupt the carriage industry? Did the spinning loom disrupt the handiwork around craftwork and sewing and textiles? And so we've had these kind of massive technological disruptions, but I think they have seldom coincided with an existential threat and the compressed time frame. And so I think that's what makes this challenge so unique. Coming back to the specific question of workforce in transition, so it's undoubtable that there is a proportion of the workforce that's in a kind of sunset situation. And whether it's tomorrow or 100 years from now, fossil fuels are finite. And so people working in the fossil fuel industry need to be found, need to discover new opportunities to retrain in the same way that people had to retrain to adopt new technology, be that, you know, email, or be that what AI might do to lots of sort of knowledge economy jobs. And so I would say we need to be very thoughtful about what we're doing for workforce transition, not least because we actually need every single spare set of hands in these roles. And I would say, right now, you know, where the cell of this opportunity is working well, that transition is working well too. It's being done in a way that is not presumptuous. So if you take steel manufacturing in the US, those kind of mid-US states, it's thinking about how do we become domestically independent for producing wind turbines and become a net exporter. But it comes with choice. So it comes with choice of saying, I want to have a comparative advantage in something, or I want to have whole independence in, you know, domestic supply of something. And again, we've seen China's jump in EV global production over the last 15 years to basically account for nearly 70% of global output on EVs from less than 2%. And clearly that's a very specific use case, a very kind of direct intervention. But to maybe carry on that very visceral experience of the decline of mining and kind of post-industrial sort of contraction in parts of the country that has left behind certain communities, I don't think it has to be that way. I think you can be very thoughtful. And that includes kind of saying, okay, what does a gigafactory in the Southwest look like? Or what does Nissan shifting to EV production mean for Sunderland? But not to just presume that those people will gravitate into those new opportunities without any real removal of frictions that involve both positioning those opportunities to them, as well as showing the roadmaps through which their skills can traverse into those future skills. And for some, those journeys might be very short. It's just that I think we have to get quite serious in understanding where are those zones where roles will need to shift, where the region industrial strategy needs to then account for that. And the skill system needs to kind of jump up to the challenge and create facilities by which employers can reap the benefits of that local workforce, rather than, as you say, that kind of hollowing out and scarring that's then left behind when people are wandering around trying to work out what might be next for them. And certainly seen in our experience of candidates is that, you know, this kind of trend of, I think, 1 million people aged over 50 dropped out of the workforce due to or just after the pandemic. And actually, in our experience, those people are in many cases willing and able to work and are potentially coming out of, say, earlier retirement from policing or the trades or the armed forces. And there just wasn't any kind of clarity on what is the conversion course if you are an older worker shifting back into the workforce and how to take on the most productive opportunity that might be available to you, not least one that can contribute to the specific nature of this mission.
So you started, you know, getting where I want to go, which is, you know, the candidates that you've worked with. Okay, you know, let's talk about the people. What I'm interested to know is, how is this kind of playing out? How's it going down? Are people quite happy to accept that the industry they work in is kind of coming to a close or will be at some point, and it is in their best interest to shift to a new industry to relearn some skills? Or I guess what I can imagine being more likely is people digging their heels in, saying, you know, not wanting change. I like my job. I've been doing it for, you know, 30 years. I'm not really willing to change at this point. Like, kind of leave me alone. What are you seeing there on the, you know, on the ground with the people that you work with?
Yeah, well, put simply, change is very hard. And I want to underline that the minority of people that we're currently working with are in these industries that are sort of under threat. I think some people are in industries where they feel, actually, if I added some further capabilities, I'm insuring myself against the prospect of that threat. So think plumbing and heating specialists that are currently working on the 1.5 million boiler replacements that are happening every year, contrast to 50,000 heat pump installations. They have some incredibly relevant and transferable skills. They are probably the most eligible population we can think of for that particular use case. But it's a much easier job replacing a boiler than it is putting in any type of heat pump. And that is also not a single person job. It's a team job that carries more diverse skills. So the complexity and the opportunity cost for those incumbent roles remains actually quite high. What we know from working with different candidates is that this is the whole spectrum of humanity that is wants to be aware and initially is very curious about what these opportunities are and how they might present an upside to whatever their current situation is. So this could be people who are leaving education, for whom it would be their first job, principally non-graduate backgrounds, but also graduate. Career changes who fall into a very broad church, but it could be people who are underemployed, so might have good qualifications, but actually have found themselves working in retail with no clarity on how they might build their skill set or progress or find the kind of the next rung up and indeed find that purpose that everyone is increasingly seeking in their work. And as I said, we do also see sort of older workers looking for some kind of unlock where training might give them pathways and understanding of what opportunity is on the other side. And so I think that use case about existing people who might be kind of under threat, I think will possibly emerge ever clearer. And there is therefore also a role for existing employers to think about their workforces in that context. But at the same time, those employers need to begin with understanding the opportunity that this transition presents for them too. And so stick with car manufacturers for the time being. 12 largest or most kind of famous and needle-moving manufacturers in the world have already committed to explicitly shifting their whole production and fleets to EVs. So that's kind of baked in. The next question is, what are they doing and what role and responsibility are they playing out for their incumbent workforce in order to optimize that workforce for the future? And so that then carries this whole question about how do you retrain and sort of shift that workforce, but also where might you have further skills gaps that you would need to hire for and anticipate also, as I said at the top of the conversation, the fact that some people might drop out of the workforce over the next 10 years due to age. And So I think that's going to be a macro trend that plays into this at a time where we sort of know what destinations we want people to be heading for. And that competition for their attention and their skills will intensify. And so I think we need to think quite carefully about what kind of future we want and who we want playing a significant role in that future. And so our job is to create the rails for that talent to step into these roles, because the consequences for not having them there are basically irreversible. And everything else is important too, be it tech or social care. But we feel that this issue in particular has no refund.
Well, let's stick on that then. Let's look forward. Let's talk about this future that you kind of envisage or would like to aim for. Be optimistic. Paint us a picture of what you think a world, or at least a country in the UK, might look like if we get a hold of this. If we manage to transition people into these jobs, and you hit this mission of yours, right? 10 million jobs in 10 years. Was that the mission? Let's say you achieve that. What does the country or the world then look like to you?
Well, as I said, the shift in global financial commitment to this is substantive, and it should be enough to sort of get us over the line, especially because, interest begets interest. So when we start seeing these kind of moves and certain things catch on, certain technologies, be it, low carbon shipping, or as we said, EVs increasingly getting to ubiquity and even price parity, suddenly you go from kind of early adopters into this sort of mass adoption kind of phase. You can't move for being able to buy a massive television for £100. And that was impossible however many years ago, not that many years ago. And that's come about because of this ubiquity and the shift and the scale and the mass production of that. And so that's the role that the workforce is playing for our economies, and the related consequence also being the decarbonization benefits of that. But in terms of the impact on the individual kind of economic and society, our starting mantra is that these are good jobs that pay well, and they are good for you, your wallet, and the planet. And so zoom out, get to 2030 to 2050, you've got these technical trade roles becoming the kind of the careers of choice, of destination, people who feel they actually have levels of flexibility, be that working in really ambitious teams and putting up solar panels and comparing how their counterparts in Australia did a similar sort of job. So part of what we're building is a community and a network that will facilitate that. And then also this kind of question about, well, actually there's utility and there's purpose and there's economic value because they're doing something that remains relevant for the absolutely kind of foreseeable future. And the more skilled they are, the more in demand their skills will be. And so the home of the future is one that is more insulated, that uses less energy, that if a new build is built from circular, sustainable materials, that has energy sources that allow us to live in a more contained, in some cases, and this is happening already, off-grid ways where people can be completely independent and sell energy back to mainstream consumption. And really part of this kind of question is, if we get enough hands on the tiller, the net result is that the opportunity of this lower cost, warmer homes, cleaner environment can proliferate and be universally accessible. Because the starting complaint is, well, I can't afford an EV or a heat pump or to insulate my home, and I'm burdened with expensive energy bills. And that, of course, is the current reality. But it doesn't have to be that way. And the way to get there at this stage is government pump priming, creating tax incentives and subsidies, which is what's happened, as I said, with the Inflation Reduction Act, or in Europe with the European Green Deal and other jurisdictions. And then how that translates into the skilled workforce that can really help us drive that transition and open up the opportunity of net zero, not just for those workers, but for communities that stand to be the beneficiaries of that ultimately. And in the meantime, remain exposed to the risks around volatility of energy insecurity, low productivity, of course, all the geopolitical chaos that we've seen over the past couple of years. And those things are here. You know, they are not temporary, because they are subject to these global disparities of where do you get your oil and gas from? How do you then put it efficiently into consumption? And how do you reduce that consumption in order to ensure that people can have more money left in their wallets, but also then are able to make choices that don't have that premium of, well, I made a green choice and therefore, you know, I'm sort of virtuous, but I'm able to afford it. Whereas actually, it just needs to be completely ubiquitous, normalized, and accessible.
What advice would you give to work, you know, listen to this show, anyone working that might be thinking in the back of their mind, you know, I have one of these jobs. I work in an industry that I can really see being disrupted in the next, you know, 5-10 years in quite a major way. I think that might be on the horizon for me. What would you advise to those people who might have those concerns?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And I do wonder, for example, if software engineers or creatives anticipated how generative AI might be disrupting their industries, as it has been over just the past 6 months, given the speed of its sort of proliferation. So I think the starting point is being as informed as possible and as alert as possible to what is happening and where the opportunity and the threat is. And then thinking through, you know, what it might mean and what some of the near-term and mid-term and long-term actions might be that don't necessarily expose you to unnecessary risk, but give you a pragmatic sort of set of choices and options. And so on a sort of simple level, I had lots of people that I kind of, you know, grew up with who trained in multi-trades. So there were plumbers and electricians, and some also went on to do some accounting courses just to cover as many bases as possible. And fundamentally, the more skilled we are, the more interdisciplinary our skills are, and the more that we acknowledge that the idea of a linear kind of 20 to 30 year career building mastery over one thing is becoming increasingly unlikely. In some cases, people might not desire that, but actually I think the level of change and dynamism and progress in our economies and the role that technology plays in that, as well as capital and the movements of capital, both out of necessity as well as, you know, interest in certain outcomes, means that you have to be quite informed about where there might be opportunities. And I've certainly seen, and you might have too, that there's this whole trend of people quitting their jobs because they don't like aspects of it. In some cases, it's been climate quitting because they don't believe that their employer exhibits the necessary stewardship and purpose of the role that it should be playing. And so I think the most important thing in making any decision is to take an informed decision that says, how do my skills translate sort of going forward? And where there might there be adjacent opportunities for me to upskill or reskill? And depending on, I guess, the specifics of every case, if you were an accountant, I would be saying, get your head around carbon numeracy and carbon accounting and helping companies understand their emissions and what can be done to reduce or eliminate those. That will be hotly in demand. If you're a plumber, start thinking about more, you know, transversal skills heading into aspects of low carbon heating and those sort of energy systems. If you're an electrician, I don't think you need to do too much to be worried. We are electrifying everything. And so you will be, you know, hotly in demand. And similarly, you know, engineers and mechanical engineers, whether recent or with longer experience, they have a significant role in understanding, say, thermal dynamics of buildings and auditing performance of buildings and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's just about understanding how to green your job effectively and what choices and routes might be available in the near term to move that.
Yeah, it's observing those threats and opportunities, isn't it? See if we can go. Let's super quickly wrap up then, if that's okay. I know I've slightly run over, but I'm going to be very cheeky and just ask you for one final thing. We always end the show by just giving a guest a chance to give a shout out to someone that they think is doing really positive work. Obviously, you yourself and your organization, Greenworks, is. And so I'd really like to hear from you guys about who you think is working hard to create a positive impact. It could be an individual, a business, an organization, someone related to your field or otherwise, but yeah, just someone that you think is worthy of a shout out.
Well, thank you. It's very hard to pick one person. And clearly, I've had the good fortune of working with so many inspiring people here and everywhere else. I've always been deeply inspired by prison officers because they are completely unseen and generally unheard, but they have possibly one of the toughest jobs available. And in particular, very inspired by the work of Unlocked Graduates, which is essentially a graduate scheme for a 2-year sort of fast track prison service placement for people that have degrees. And evidently, anybody like leaving a good degree, thinking about making that level of commitment for a couple of years to change a number of lives in extremely tough circumstances, ones that I understood very well over the past sort of decade working in that space, is something that, you know, I'm still deeply in awe of. So yeah, in particular wanted to recognize Locked Graduates and all of them, as well as people working.
Amazing. Fantastic answer. Matt, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. I really learned a lot there. I enjoyed that and wish you all the best with it and take care of yourself.
Thanks so much. You too.
It's guests like this that remind me of the wider big picture shift that needs to happen. I know I've spoken a lot about wanting to get a mix of guests, from those that have actionable advice for the likes of you and I, to those working on projects that are seeking profound shifts in the way our societies operate. You can definitely put this one right alongside, say, Tom from Honest Ocean, for example, from our last episode. Really big questions that work at a societal level. I come away from these chats very grateful, actually, that someone is out there working on this stuff, because some of these issues, they feel so big, we can bury our head in the sand a little bit and hope that someone else will solve it, someone else's problem. Now, it very much is our problem. It will affect all of us. But yeah, some of these issues are just too big for many of us to understand. So I am really, really glad that there are very smart people like Matt who are qualified to do this work, and they are working hard at it. But enough about me. Tell me what you thought. Are you someone, or do you know someone, working in an industry that's likely to be disrupted by this green shift? Are you concerned? Let me know. You can get in touch on cpi@soundquake.co.uk, or you can use Spotify's Q&A function. Or you know what? Maybe you can actually reach out to Greenworks. They may well have the answers for you. The link to them is in the show notes. And while we're there, a reminder that a link to Mr. X, the toy appeal charity I mentioned at the top of the show, there's a link from them in there as well. I'm doing this now because it's right around the time that they like to see people getting involved. And if you're not listening to this when it goes out, which is November 2023, then, well, hello from the past. And just hang on till October, November time, whenever you're listening to this, and that's when they start to open this back up again. I'd love it if you could follow this show, or you know what, even better, send this episode to someone that you know. Share the link, send it to someone who might really enjoy it. I'm not overly fussed on ratings, but getting this directly into the hands of people who will get value from it is very important to me. And I think the best way to do that is word of mouth from trusted people, people like you. It's also personally something I really like doing for friends. I'll stop now, because I'm sure my nasal tones are driving me up the wall. Thank you for persevering with me. I will see you next week.